From WXXI News, I'm Matt DeTurk, filling in today for Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. In 1949, director Chuck Jones and writer Mike Maltese made history with Fast and Furious, the first Looney Tunes cartoon starring the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. 75 years later, these beloved characters have become bona fide cultural icons, starring in cartoons, comic books, films, television shows, video games, and even more. So it's no surprise when it was announced that Warner Brothers was producing a live-action animation hybrid film called Coyote vs. Acme about the characters. Scripted, directed, and filmed, the film was completed in 2023 and then suddenly was shelved by Warner Brothers Discovery in order to obtain a $30 million tax write-down instead of releasing the film. Going back a bit further in animation history, Fleischer Studios was a pioneer in the art and craft of animation and were responsible for creating some of the most beloved characters in American pop culture, including Betty Boop and Coco the Clown, as well as being the animation studio bringing Popeye and Superman to life. But these films have all become extremely difficult to find or watch in a quality presentation, so a dedicated grassroots team has embarked on brand new digital restorations on their own to preserve these films and their characters. So joining me to discuss all this today, here in the studio with me is Dan Senker, author of Dance of the Comedians, 75 Years of the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. Thanks, Dan, for joining me.
Matt, thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
And on the phone is Ray Poynter, animation historian and author of The Art and Inventions of Max Fleischer. Glad to have you, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, I want to start by asking, how did you decide on Roadrunner and the Coyote as the topic to write a book about?
Oh, my gosh. Well, ever since I was about three, the Roadrunner and Coyote have always been my absolute favorite cartoon characters. I'm sure, like all of us have grown up watching them, there's something singularly unique about these characters. They kind of seem to have a very special place in Looney Tunes history and American culture. And with this being their 75th anniversary year, I thought it would be the perfect time to write a book. In the 80s and 90s, and even today, whenever a famous animated character has a milestone birthday or anniversary of their debut short, the studios like to make a big deal about it. Bugs Bunny's 50th anniversary in 1990, oh my gosh, there was new cartoons. He was on the cover of Time magazine. There was new merchandise. There was this huge, huge deal. And even this week, I don't know how they're going to do it, but Donald Duck is going. You saw this.
I did.
Donald Duck is going to be the guest star on Hot Ones.
Yep.
Where this week for his 90th anniversary, where apparently he will be eating cauliflower.
I did see that. There was a lot of discussion over what he'd be eating.
Exactly. And of course, every year, Mickey Mouse's birthday is always a huge deal for Disney. All that to say, with the characters turning 75, with the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote turning 75 this year, three quarters of a century, milestone birthday, I thought that it would be a great time for a historical, critical, cultural study of these icons. And at the time I started writing it, the Coyote versus Acme movie was right around the corner. So I thought it would be a perfect time to write this book with that movie coming out.
Yeah, that makes that
at the time.
It was a good thought at the time.
Of course.
Ray, speaking of books and related to film in that case, so you've written a book on Fleischer, and you've been involved as a historian with the studio for over 50 years. How did you come about to have that relationship?
57, to be exact.
57 years.
Wow.
That's amazing.
But as I say in my prologue, this is something that I've done more than just give lip service to. I've lived it. Actually, because I was of the first generation who saw the Fleischer cartoons when they were first put on television in 1956. And that's before a lot of the people that are writing about animation now were ever born. So I came along during that time when there weren't that many restrictions about what you could show on television at that time. So I was exposed to all of those things, even with PC elements still intact. So that sort of explains what's the matter with me. But it was the Out of the Inkwell cartoons that really caught my attention and made me want to be an artist and animator. And I had a dream about that, which I explained in my prologue, where I met Max Fleischer, and I did like Alice Through the Looking Glass and stepped to the television screen and met him in a black and white world and visited him in his office. And during the course of that visit, I accidentally upturned his famous inkwell with a blot of ink splashing out, and out of a reflex, he jumped up and dropped me. And I had wakened from the dream with one foot tangled up in the quilt like Little Nemo in Slumberland.
Wow.
That's amazing. 10 years later, during that time after that, though, I was experimenting with animation. And just before I entered high school, I had an interview at Jam Handy. Now, during World War II, Max Fleischer came there as the head of the animation department manager. So this was in June of 1967. And during my interview, I was showing the work that I was completing on an animated production of The Wizard of Oz, which was a half hour. And I had always been fascinated by those 3D background effects that were in the Fleischer cartoons. And I tried to figure out my own way of duplicating that same effect. So I did it with cutouts on raised levels of glass and that sort of thing. And so you have the advantage of natural shadows with the lighting and casting natural shadows and that sort of thing. And you can move the camera in and out and get the same parallax effects. So during the middle of this, these two elderly gentlemen had wandered in and they were standing in front of the crowd. And I was introduced to these animation pioneers, Frank Goldman and his very best friend, Max Fleischer. And it turned out that he was on his way to Expo 67, and he stopped in to see some old friends. And Max had seen what I was doing at the time, and he spent 20 minutes talking to me. And that's 20 minutes I'll never forget. So it seems like that whole dream came full cycle 10 years later. So over the years, and of course I had acquired some anecdotes from some of the people still working there who worked with Max during that period. And then when I went into college, I started formal research on that starting in 1970. So after all that, I've for years had an obligation to do restitution for having upset Max Fleischer's famous inkwell.
That's amazing. I feel like that kind of like an initial sense of like when you first got kind of like exposed or witnessed to these like characters, I feel like has such like a profound effect on like people's memory and then like their sense of like animation. I think the first time that I encountered Betty Boop was on an old VHS tape that my great aunt had in like a stack of things in her house. Dan, do you remember maybe some of like your early like kernels of like animation?
Oh my gosh, very, very much like Ray in his prologue. This is how I start out the book. Grandma Han's couch, watching the Bugs Bunny and Tweety show in the early 90s in Williamsville, New York. Sometimes with my sister, sometimes with my cousins. I grew up in the 1990s, which was a great time for animation, both new shows, obviously, and also classic older cartoons being played on ABC, Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon. And so I certainly watched Looney Tunes and The Roadrunner at home with my family, but the main place where I fell in love with The Roadrunner and Bugs Bunny and kept seeing that name Chuck Jones, Friz Freleng, that was absolutely at my Grandma Han's house, just as a kid.
That's awesome.
Yep.
I feel like this is a good moment of talking about, like, I think that one of the great ways, like, as people get access to animation, like, whether it's in whatever medium people come across it in that case, but as a person who very, very much believes in the theatrical experience, like, of seeing things in a movie theater, I'm super excited that we are going to be launching your book this coming Thursday, August 29th, at the Little Theater. With a screening of Chuck Jones's The Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie, and we're gonna spend some time talking about your book after that.
I am super excited. If you are in Rochester, please come to the Little. I'm honored. We're gonna be in Theater One.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is super cool. Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie. It is a 1979 compilation movie of essentially Chuck Jones' greatest hits, and it culminates in a massive supercut of Roadrunner cartoons. So I will be there. I will be, like Matt said, I'll be launching my book. I'll be able to sign copies and talk to people and talk to Matt after the movie. And I'm just super excited for the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great time. So if you literally haven't actually had a chance to see animation of, like, this era on the big screen, I definitely encourage you to come out and check it out. It's going to be a ton of fun. But speaking of animation and, like, having another life in theaters right now, Ray, so there's actually a group of people working on the restoration process of the Fleischer cartoons, and they're currently working on some screenings around the country. Can you talk a little bit about, like, how that process is going?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I've been sort of under the wire, so to speak, as a consultant on a lot of that, because I also have a photographic background. I was a photographer's mate in the Navy. I was a motion picture specialist, but I have lab experience, too. So I was required to know color theory. So I'm probably one of the most qualified people to tell you whether the color balance looks right and things of that nature. But I've made the appearances at most of the screenings across the country. And, of course, that's a good opportunity to showcase my book, too. But it's always been exciting because we've always had sellouts. The people are very excited about seeing these because they're seeing them on the large screen probably for their very first experience. Whether they've seen them on home video or not really doesn't matter, because we've got two reasons why this is a new experience for them. For one thing, they're seeing the versions that have been taken from the original negatives. And we've had the good fortune with the cooperation of Paramount to gain access to their original elements, so you can't beat that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And then, two, this is the first time that there have been any attempts to do this digitally. So you can understand why this is a plus,
yeah.
Especially when it comes to the Technicolor cartoons, because we're able to scan off from the original successive exposure negatives instead of this coming from a third generation print.
Yeah, I bet it just looks, I don't want to say like night and day, but literally like just an incredible difference in that case between what people may have found on, you know, YouTube, for example, and then what you guys are putting together.
Well, not only that, in addition just to the resolution, but it's just that the nuances in the artwork are displayed in a way that's never been seen before. I mean, I'm even impressed with the quality of the inking. And the home video versions are such an exaggeration of the care that went into these, because there are duplications and duplications and duplications. Things become mushed out, and the lines look ugly and thick. And when you go to the originals, you see how delicately it was handled. And the other thing, too, is that the older transfers were on the NTSC system, which was limited to its color reproduction range. We no longer have that problem now with digital.
Right, yeah. Wow. Ray, do you have a specific favorite, like, character from the Fleischer, like, pantheon of characters?
Well, even though he's not a Fleischer character, but he was certainly the headliner for Paramount for 24 years, and that's Popeye.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's interesting, but it's also an objective criticism of the Fleischer Studios, is the fact that their only original character of worth was really Betty Boop, and to a degree she was certainly derivative, but their greatest success was enhancing established characters, which they certainly did with Popeye. Mm. What they did with Popeye was actually to enhance his personality beyond what originated in the comic strip. And the same thing can be done with Superman as well. In fact, the entire idea of Superman flying came out of the animated version from Fleischer Studios.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I didn't know that, actually. That's super cool.
But there's also an interesting parallel between Popeye and Superman in the fact that they operate on the same premise. Even though Popeye played for comedy and Superman was dramatic, they both have transformational climax or denouement gimmicks. You know, for Popeye, it's the spinach to turn the tables. And in Superman, it's Clark Kent changing in privacy to Superman.
I never thought about
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Popeye was relevant to the situation in the 1930s, and it carried on, and Superman the 1940s.
Huh. That's amazing. Yeah. I admit, I feel like my, like, what I've seen of the Fleischer Studios work is, like, very limited, and I don't think I've seen any of the Superman ones, and I haven't seen, you know,
Well, another
Popeye.
Thing that they were clever about is that they had a similar premise in each of their series, but they never did it the same way. And this goes back even to Out of the Inkwell. You still have the format established where Max Fleischer was in the most of them. So he's established as the credible artist who draws these things. And the other thing, too, that was amazing about that series was that it was probably one of the earliest series of that nature that was not afraid to use experimental animation that others were not using. Mm-hmm. They used all sorts of forms of experimental animation, including hand-drawn animation with cutouts. They used claymation sometimes. They used pixelization. And not very many other people were doing that.
I think that's one of those things about when you have, like, a situation where a bunch of artists actually both, of course, are working on, like, a commercial property, but have a little bit more freedom to experiment in that case, and especially within that time frame. Like, I think that you get some, like, really amazing work that then ends up becoming super, super influential, like, as time goes on. I'm really hoping that we'll have a chance to screen some of the Fleischer work here in Rochester soon. But Dan, I think you mentioned that in Buffalo.
Yeah. So this is just fascinating. Next month, I'm actually bringing my book, Dance of the Comedians, and the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie to back home to Buffalo, where I'm from. And it's going to be screening on the Saturday the 14th at 11:30 in the North Park Theater. And I just found out that directly after my screening and book event at 4:30... on Saturday, September 14th, of all things, North Park Theater in Buffalo is going to be showing on the big screen some of these restored Fleischer cartoons. And there will also be a Q&A with some of the restorers, Sam Davis and Thad Komorowski. And that is, Ray, when I heard you were going to be on the show today, that's why I got so excited. There just continues to be a lot of Fleischer Warner Brothers overlap in Western New York.
As it should be, because one of the things that's unique about them is that in the annals of animation, Fleischer's was the big New York studio. They weren't part of the Hollywood scene.
Yep.
So the way they developed was almost in a vacuum without the influence of what was going on the West Coast until years later when they moved to Miami.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I can bring this connection even closer to home for all three of us. There is a fascinating connection between Rochester, New York. Well, Rochester and both Warner Brothers and Fleischer Studios. On the Warner side, one of Chuck Jones' background artists, Bob Gribarek, was born in Rochester, and he studied at RIT. He was also the art director at the Rochester Science Museum.
Oh, cool.
I mentioned him in the book. He did the backgrounds on the all Chuck Jones cartoons. And then Ray, I'll give you the Rochester half of the Fleischer connection. And then you can mention the relevance to Fleischer. Rochester, New York is the birthplace of the band leader Cab Calloway. Cab was born in Rochester Christmas Day 1907, and the park Otto Hendersburg Square Park on 4 Sycamore Street. If you go to this park, there's a plaque commemorating Cab Calloway, who wrote the song Minnie the Moocher. He's, as far as I know, he's the first black artist to sell a million copies of a single. And he had more than a little to do with the Fleischer cartoons.
That's partly true. It's the other way around, though. Lou Fleischer, who was the musical director at Fleischer Studios, attended the Cotton Club frequently, and he developed a personal relationship with Cab Calloway. And so it was actually Lou who was influential in making those cartoons with Cab Calloway, as well as the other two jazz cartoons with Louis Armstrong and Don Redman.
So can you mention, just because I certainly know as an animation geeky nerd guy, but for the average person, people might not know about Cab Calloway and Max Fleischer at all, especially Snow White.
Well, one thing that's significant about the Snow White cartoon is that it has been entered into the Library of Congress collection of American culture, and that's quite a high honor.
Yeah. Yep.
Ray, I was wondering also in this case, like when you talk about like the various history of like of the characters and of the studio, like is the studio still around today?
Oh, sure. Well, it was reestablished in the 1970s with the intention to merchandise the Betty Boop character. And Max Fleischer spent his last remaining years until his health didn't allow for him to continue. And his daughter, Ruth, who was married to Seymour Nitell, picked that up. And they finally settled that just before Max passed away in September of 1972. And it was a month after he passed away that I interviewed her. And she told me that they had the merchandise deal set with King Features in 1972. So it's through the merchandising that people know who Betty Boop is, and a lot of them are not even aware that she was a cartoon character of the 1930s. So again, when they come to these screenings, they're seeing something that they weren't aware of. And the fact that we have these three Cab Calloway cartoons with her in them is another discovery.
That's amazing. I literally had no idea about that connection. That's cool. Like, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll have more with our guest, Dan Senker, author of Dance of the Comedians, 75 Years of the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, and Ray Poynter, animation historian and author of The Art and Inventions of Max Fleischer. We'll be right back.
Coming up in our second hour, my colleague Matt DeTurk hosts the program with a focus on theme parks. Do you still go to Seabreeze or Darien Lakes? Walt Disney himself once said that Disneyland would never be fully completed as long as there's still imagination left in the world. The implication is that change is always happening. But how do you balance the need for something new and exciting with the classics? Matt explores it next hour.
And we're back. This is Connections. I'm Matt DeTurk, sitting in for Evan Dawson. We are talking about classic animated cartoon characters and their role in our current society. I'm joined here by our guest, Dan Senker, author of Dance of the Comedians, 75 Years of Roadrunner and the Coyote, and Ray Poynter, animation historian and author of The Art and Inventions of Max Fleischer. Thank you guys both for being here. For anybody who is listening, if you have a question for our guests, you can call 844-295-TALK, toll-free. If you're in Rochester, the number is 585-263-9994, or you can email the show at connections@wxxi.org. Dan, you were saying, my entire life, this is that whole thing about, like, the coyote doesn't speak in that case, and the roadrunner just beeps.
Yeah.
So I've been pronouncing the Cody's name wrong my entire life. Please correct me.
Well, no. So it's very interesting. The coyote's name is a bit of a nightmare. While E. Coyote. I guess technically if someone was to say his name without the E initial, it would just be While, which sounds weird.
It was supposed to be a play on words, a Wiley.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. And in some of the old Dell and Gold Key comics, they give, other characters. You know, there's like a cartoon where he has a father named Crafty Coyote, Crafty. Wiley Coyote, in his cartoons with the Roadrunner, doesn't speak. He's not even technically named Wiley Coyote until he appears in a small series of cartoons with Bugs Bunny, where he does speak, and that is when they gave him the name Wiley Coyote.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
He was identified as that on the Bugs Bunny show because there's the network promo. Maybe some people have seen that on YouTube. And Bugs Bunny has these playing cards with the characters that are featured on the show. Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote, that's how he was established for the public on television.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Fascinating. So it's literally in that case, it was like years and years and years and years later where he got like an official name-ish?
It's very convoluted. It's not very convoluted. The first Roadrunner cartoon, 1949, Fast and Furious, that's the first animated appearance of the coyote. And then both the Roadrunner and the coyote sort of dropped off the map for a couple years. And then in 1952... Chuck Jones directed a cartoon called Operation Rabbit, which is the Coyote's second animated appearance, first without the Roadrunner. And in this cartoon, he's with Bugs Bunny for the first time. He goes by Wile E. Coyote. He has this silly little business card, Wile E. Coyote, super genius, which is a phrase that people are kind of familiar with.
Yeah.
So Wile E. Coyote appeared with Bugs in a handful of shorts in the 50s and 60s. And then by the time he appeared on television, Ray's absolutely right. If you give a character a name, it sounds better to use that for brand recognition, for kids, for the television series. Yeah.
So I'm going to kick this question to Dan, and then Ray, I'll kick it to you as well. Like, in this case, we're talking about, again, through various media, through various pieces of history, and in some cases, like a convoluted mess of records. How do you go about researching in this case, like something like that for book purposes?
Well, I am much, much newer to the game of animation history. I grew up watching these cartoons as a kid, but as I became a teenager, I realized that, if you take history, film history is a subset of history. Animation history is a very specific form of film history. And all throughout the 80s, 90s, and 2000s especially, you have these incredible, almost like textbooks. You have history books written by historians like, oh my gosh, Jerry Beck, Leonard Maltin, Michael Barrier, and Ray Poynter's right in there too, with these animation historians who give very academic treatments of mostly Warner Brothers and certainly Disney, for sure.
Well, but, if I might chime in there,
yeah.
Really, the person who really started this whole realization and made this seem serious was Christopher Finch.
Oh, yeah.
His publication of The Art of Walt Disney. That's really what I think really created that whole new book publishing genre mm-hmm. on animation history, and people started to take it seriously. And quite frankly, this was my generation who grew up seeing these things on television mm-hmm. and gained this sense of animation history that had never been realized before. Previous to that, the first animation history books that were ever written were written in 1940. And nothing of any real consequence and depth had been written for 25 years.
Wow. So, Ray, in that case, when because of like when you mentioned like your previous like earlier access to like the studio and everything combined with that, is that like what caused you to be like, oh, I have access and nothing like this has been written? And is that what caused you to, in effect, write your book?
No. It was because of when I mentioned that I worked that summer at Jam Handy. I worked around a lot of people who had worked with Max, and I had all these anecdotes, and that's when I learned that he was an inventor. And so then when I started college, I started in full force. And the fortunate thing is, in Detroit, the Detroit Main Library had a patents room. So I went in there and I researched all of his patents and made copies of them and read through them and gained an understanding as to how these mechanisms worked. So for many years, there was never anything in great depth about Fleischer. The most that I had ever read that had been written about his history was sometime around 1964. We were visiting a cousin's place, and I was left alone in his library, and he had a collection of the Richardson encyclopedias. And that entry probably had the most extensive history on Max Fleischer that I had ever read.
Wow.
And I had that memorized. So naturally, when I was interviewed at Jam Handy, I knew what these people were talking about. But other than that, the few mentions that were in books were just superficial. And they didn't really go into the depth.
Right.
So fortunately, that has been corrected in recent years.
I think the first time I took not just notice of animation, but like really specifically was like, oh, wait, this is something I hadn't seen before, was I think in Richard Williams' animations for Raggedy Ann and Andy, A Musical Adventure, and some of the staircase sequences, which, you know, I read since that people talked about like relating back to The Thief and the Cobbler and, and all of those aspects of it. But I think that like that's the thing. I think everyone, you eventually find a moment, I think, where you're like, wait, this does something different that I haven't seen before, or I don't know, has an emotional like hook and connection to you, which is why I'm partially going to transition here into a little bit about talking about like currently how Hollywood seems to be treating animation a little bit.
That's interesting, Matthew, but to get back to your initial question, really you were asking me about a motivation as well. And the thing is that I had enjoyed what Disney had to offer, but at the same time, the public had been just so brainwashed, and they had just been fed so much of the Disney perspective that animation does not begin and end with what Disney did. It's such an all-encompassing medium. And the fact that during the course of the development of the industry during the 1930s, Max was pretty much left in the shadow of Walt Disney's accomplishments. And Max was really established a generation before Disney ever came along. And in all fairness, Disney profited on the developments of those who came before him, which is fine, but he did not invent the medium.
Of course. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And Fleischer was one of those people who did, and Disney benefited from some of the things that Fleischer had invented. So my motivation was to bring Max out of the shadow and make people realize that he not only existed, but he is worth considering too. And not only that, the content of their cartoons was so much different.
Oh, yeah.
And adults get it. Those cartoons were never originally intended for children anyway.
That is, I think, one of the biggest, like, interesting things about, like, currently where we are now with in terms of animation. I know that this has been, like, I don't want to say, like, repeated over and over, but, you know, like, I feel like it keeps coming up, is that, like, we've gone into a situation now where people, a lot of people, associate animation, cartoons, as for kids, and are discounting like the fact that animation, again, as you said, and as Guillermo del Toro had a great quote that I'm going to butcher now about the fact that animation being a medium, not a genre, like is about the fact that like so much good storytelling can happen within animation for people of all ages. I just saw yesterday that talking about Warner Brothers, but like they're one of their big like tentpole releases for this holiday season is a Lord of the Rings animated movie set in Middle Earth, of course, because Lord of the Rings, but like it's 2D animated and they're putting it in IMAX and it's not made for kids.
No. Yep.
Well, the subject matter is quite cerebral. There have been many attempts at trying to do real adult level films. I don't mean pornography level. That's not adult.
Right.
What we mean by adult is complicated situations that involve adult reasoning and a reflection on adult experiences. And by the way, even though the Betty Boop cartoons, the pre-code ones, were at the time considered risque and they're rather tame by today's standards, I want to share with you a funny anecdote, because a number of years ago, Kalamazoo, Michigan, for about 3 years, hosted the Kalamazoo Animation Festival, and I was asked to participate in that. And so my first year that I was there, the young student who was operating the digital projection equipment there said to me, "I get the Popeyes, but I don't get Betty Boop." I said, "You will when you're older."
I think that one of those things about like what do like the characters and who are they like for actually relates to this question that we got emailed about, which reads, "Charlie Brown, Snoopy, Linus, and Lucy are exactly what I need them to be, where I need them to be, on my bookshelf spread across 26 volumes. I don't want the gang reimagined or continued. Especially in today's world that has an annoying tendency to censor things, I'm looking at you, an unarmed Elmer Fudd." Which I think is, again, kind of that interesting sense about, like, what do we do with these characters now in this current day and age? In the sense that, like, again, not to focus on Disney, but because they're such a huge company in this case, and now they're doing this whole, like, process of redoing all of their animated films in quote-unquote live action, but I'm looking at you, The Lion King, you're still animation.
And my answer to that is, leave it alone. Why are you doing it? It just goes to show you that they have no imagination.
Yes.
Because back in the day when the originators were active, they were always moving forward. And one thing that to Disney's credit is the fact that he did not want to look back and imitate what had already been done. He only did that one time because of the success of The Three Little Pigs, that United Artists, and particularly Mary Pickford, kept begging and begging and begging him to make sequels with the three pigs. So they made two or three after that just to satisfy her request, but they never were as popular as the original one. That's always the case.
Yeah.
You know, once you have a hit or you have a success, you're obligated to duplicate that success, and it doesn't always work.
Yeah, no, I would say.
Because it becomes a self-imitation.
Yeah. I would say, yeah. I feel like a fair amount of the time it doesn't work.
And Matt, I appreciate you saying that the, you know, with air quotes for the live action, the new Lion King movie, make no mistake, it is fully animated.
Yeah.
It is hyper photorealistic, very, very, very impressive CGI.
Yeah.
The director, he said that he put one shot that has no CGI, it is all live action, one shot in the movie to see if audiences could tell it apart. And I have no idea what the shot is.
Me neither.
And, you know, as a millennial who is very protective of The Lion King and an animation nerd who just loves the medium of traditional animation as a whole, you know, if you're going to remake the pinnacle of Walt Disney Studios to look like, you know, real lions and warthogs and meerkats, but you're still doing it in animation, that just shows how powerful animation is. You cannot make a live action Lion King.
Yeah.
You can make it look as live action as possible, but yeah, it's, you know, I agree with Ray. You pick the worst animated Disney movie, traditional hand drawn animated, and you set it aside the best of the live action or semi live action remakes. And I can almost guarantee you the animated movie will be better.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's unfortunate in this is that the people who are in the business now do not understand the magic of animation and what it does.
Mm-hmm.
One of the arguments that was going on when Bambi was in production was that they had so much reference to live-action footage to follow to duplicate the movements of the real animals, which worked very well, but they interpreted it too.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the arguments they said was, if you're going to so slavishly copy live action, you may as well make a live action movie and be done with it.
Right.
But the point of it is, though, that you're running the risk of really distorting reality, because real life animals do not react like human beings and they do not talk.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, there are some children, either through a lack of guidance through their parents or maybe some mental issues, having difficulty telling the difference between fantasy and reality, are led to believe when they see this in a movie that real animals behave this way. And I've seen a video of some silly girls approaching a wild bear talking to it.
Oh, boy.
So you think in that case, actually having a distance between like photorealism in that case and then something that is not photorealistic is actually kind of important?
Yes, it is, because you've got people that can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality anymore. And we're already approaching that point now with the influence of AI.
Oh, man.
I was like, oh, I don't even know if we have enough space in the show to talk about AI and the topic of animation. I mean, like, we can, but you know what I mean? But, like, that's a whole other kettle of fish that I feel like is going to has already started drastically affecting, you know, the animation industry in that case.
And then you've even got some of the same arguments about some people who had problems with old comedies and they tried to read in a lot of current PC things and everything like that. And anybody who's mature enough to understand the context and of those things and so forth, they're willing to accept it for what it was, and we go on with it. And so we have to look at where we are today and deal with the situations that are before us now. And that means that we have the ability to use our imagination to apply them to what is currently relevant in the 21st century. And those things that were made before, they stand as icons, and I think that they need to be left as such because we need to create more.
I do think it's interesting that, like, the studios do seem to be having a very difficult time figuring out what to do with their animation properties, their animated characters. I literally had no idea that in addition to Coyote versus Acme, that Warner Brothers Animation had another Looney Tunes film in production called The Day the Earth Blew Up.
Yep.
Like, but I just found out that Warner Brothers isn't distributing it.
Well, The Day the Earth Blew Up and trust me, once Coyote versus Acme got canceled, let's be very clear. People with projects in production at Warner Brothers are understandably very, very nervous because, you know, there is this habit that Dave Zaslav is, you know, forming of green lighting movies. The movies are made and then up, the movies get shelved. So the Day the Earth Blew Up, which it's going to be very interesting. It stars, Daffy and Porky. I don't think Warner Brothers is distributing it. I know that it is going to be shown. It just got approved for, or just bought for a North American release. But there even was a third Looney Tunes movie. I think it was called Bye Bye Bunny.
Mm.
It was going to be a Looney Tunes musical. That movie got canceled, within the last year or two.
Wow.
So to your point, you know, Warner Brothers is either not taking chances on these characters or taking chances on them and, you know, like going back at the last second. But it's very sad. Disney has always more or less had a good handle on what to do with Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. Mickey is not going anywhere. Today, if you ask kids, hey, who are the Looney Tunes? They will certainly say Bugs, Tweety, and Taz. They will probably say the Roadrunner and Coyote or Daffy. But some of them might leave it at that. Or frankly, some of them might say, Scooby-Doo, which who's not even Looney Tunes. Yeah. So it is pretty sad to see, but not hopeless, to see how Warner Brothers is handling their, Ray mentioned that Fleischer had Betty Boop as their number one original creation. And if you take Warner Brothers both as an animation studio but also as a film studio, and if you simply ask who is the most iconic character created by Warner Brothers, not bought, not like Harry Potter or Warner's brought DC so they got Superman, but who is the most iconic, closely associated character with Warner Brothers? It would have to be Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
No doubt about that.
No doubt.
By the way, if I can chime in, Dan.
Yeah.
It's funny that the day the Earth blew up sounds almost like a deja vu going back to 1928 with Coco's Earth Control.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good one. I love that one. Yep. Yep, it is going to have some sort of sci-fi element, I believe, yeah.
Ray, from your perspective, I know this is kind of a big question, but you mentioned at one point, some of the Fleischer stuff is within, Paramount, but, it's both been good and also difficult to try to, get to some of it. Why do you think studios now don't quite know what to do with their animated characters?
Well, if we're going to focus on the Fleischer library itself,
sure,
that's a complicated situation in the way that Paramount sold those films back in the 1950s, because they went into three different directions. The largest share of the entire old Paramount short subject library was sold originally to UM&MTV Productions, UM&MTV Corporation, I should say. And then as they were starting to make the reduction prints for syndication, they originally tried to sell to CBS, Paramount did. And UM ended up beating them out on the bid, so they had a local TV station syndication plan, which meant that they had to make 16-millimeter prints. And halfway through the process of that, starting in 1955, they sold to National Telefilm Associates, who continued the conversions. So by the time they started selling the TV package, they were still making those reductions. Now, that covers about 2,500 subjects, not just the cartoons. There were about 1,200 cartoons, but there was another 1,200 to 1,300 live-action short subjects as well. So the non-Popeyes went to those two companies, primarily through distribution through NTA. The Popeyes were sold the following year to AAP, which was folded into United Artists a few years later. The Supermans were sold to Flamingo Telefilm Sales. So that's part of the confusion right there and how those companies maintained those films. So fast forward, when NTA finally got out of television syndication of short films in the 70s, they pretty much forgot about them. And the primary reason is because when we get into the 1960s, the seven-year licenses on those packages started to expire between 1962 and 64. By that time, color television was around the corner for local stations. And so effective 1965, you have color television all over the place, and they wanted color. So there was no interest in those black and white films. And for many reasons, that's why these films were out of circulation for decades, because it was thought that they were obsolete. There was no interest in them, and they were considered dormant, or the material was considered dated. So it wasn't until the 1970s and through underground screenings that these films were rediscovered and discovered for the the art that they are.
Oh yeah,
And the retrospectives that were starting just before Max passed away, the most important of them being the Betty Boop scandals of 1974, and that's how some of these became cult classics.
I'm so glad that, like, again, the team and you are working on the process of restoring these. So again, like, the art is so important, the actual history is so important. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that people are getting a chance to see them in, like, in collections again.
Mm-hmm. And to get back to the initial issue about the challenge of the films, it's, as I say when we go on our tours, I explain that doing this is like looking at a collection of library books. And when you have the collection of books, you have bookends. Well, the section of it that's the easiest to access is those that are the Paramount negatives.
Yeah.
The two bookends include the pre-Paramount period of the silent era and the post-Paramount period when Max was doing industrials in Detroit. Those are the hardest to come by, and we're trying to work on those too.
Ray, I am so excited that people are getting a chance to see these again on the big screen. I hope people get a chance to go to the North Park in Buffalo on September 14th, see the Fleischer Program. We hope to bring it to Rochester. I want to thank, of course, Dan Senker, author of Dance of the Comedians, 75 Years of Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Ray Poynter, animation historian, author of Art and Invention, Max Fleischer. So excited to present stuff at The Little. Thank you all for listening. Thanks for listening to WXXI.
Thank you.
That's all, folks.